I'm Ira, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Hi, Ira.
Tonight's speaker is Donnie. I met Donnie in, I just realized, September of 99, right? No, okay. He started coming to a meeting that I had been a regular at for about 5 years before that. And it's what I saw in Donnie when he walked in was somebody who was miserable. His life was unmanageable. And I watched him grow over the years as at that meeting and at big book studies and watching him take others through the book, just the way it's prescribed, subscribed, and the way we're told to do it. And Donnie will be a good speaker. If he's not, see me afterwards. I'll give you your money back. With that, I give you Donnie.
I'm Donnie, and I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Donnie.
Appreciate the opportunity to come out here and share tonight. Yeah, Ira and Jerry also was came into that meeting after I guess probably had a couple years clean and sober, and I was the secretary of that meeting, and it was a huge meeting. We had a lot of people coming in. We had a lot of chairs that had to be stacked and unstacked, and Jerry jumped right in there along with Ira and other and helped, but Jerry was instrumental in helping through service work at that meeting. And so when he asked me to come do this, I said, you know, I certainly could turn Jerry down as much as he helped me. And so I don't do a lot of speaker meetings, so, you know, I'm certainly not on any circuit or anything, but I just want to share my experience, strength, and hope, and hopefully, you know, somebody in here will benefit from that. I know we don't have any new people in here, but if we've got some folks in here that are maybe just getting into the book, which I see a sponsee of mine in here tonight that's going through the book, and maybe some other folks that you can really get out of what's in that. And I'm going to share a little bit about my I was born in Marietta. I'm a native, you know. It's kind of odd these days. You don't meet a lot of natives that grew up right here in the city. You know, so many people, you know, transplant coming in from all over. But from Marietta. I think I met somebody else here tonight that was actually from Marietta. And, or as we say over there, Marietta, right? I mean, if you're really from Marietta, it's Marietta. But grew up in the East Cobb area. Actually, I'm an only child. I mean, right, I'm unique, right? That's where out of the gate, I was a terminal uniqueness. But I'm an only child. My parents were divorced before I was even a year old, so I kind of grew up a single mom. Before I go down this path of, you know, making it sound like there was any excuses whatsoever, both of my parents loved me dearly, and my grandparents loved me dearly. I had grandfathers on both sides of the family, my mom's father and my dad's father, that were alcoholics. And, you know, there's a whole cauldron of debate of, you know, if that jumps generation, and some people have it the same way, and some people that believe in spiritual matters believe that sins pass from one generation to the next. Whatever, you know, I was taught right from wrong, and I knew the first time that I tried to drink and drug that I was doing something that I had been cautioned about and that was not right, you know, and that, you know, there were ominous warnings, like it says in Bill's story, about drink and as it pertained to me and my background and everything that had gone through, but I did it anyway. We moved around a lot, my mother, you know, I mean, like I said, I'm going to badger her. She grew up in you know, a real poverty-stricken area, and she had a lot of fears and anxieties of herself, but she always provided me, always kept a roof over my head, but we moved around a lot. I mean, she had different boyfriends, and we'd move every 6 months at least. Turned out, or she got a new job, we moved all over Marietta. It seems like I was in and out of one school district to another, and we lived off Atlanta Road inside the perimeter, and not the best of schools at the times, in the, you know, in the 70s, and anyway, my dad was always locally and more than happy to come pick me up on the weekends and help me. I mean, I had a very loving father, but I know that the parents, my background, were always, my grandparents were, you know, poor little Donnie. You know, he just didn't have two parents. You know, back in the 70s, it was kind of an odd thing, you know, I guess even more so early on in the 60s, parents not to be together, you know, and so I can remember my grandparents, everybody trying to make me feel special, you know, and maybe even, you know, it sowed in a little self-pity, but also I had this special uniqueness. I felt like I was unique, you know, and but this uniqueness kind of combined with a little bit of not a little bit, but a little bit of insecurity, and kind of felt, you know, like I was constantly being moved around in between, you know, parents at times, and always had this fear and anxiety. My mom kind of had this going on in her life a lot, and a lot of her moving around, and I can remember just always not feeling right, you know, just kind of feeling a little bit always concerned and fearful and frightened in my life. And anyway, mom trying to do her best. She married somebody in the 70s, and we went from, you know, South Atlanta Road to Indian Hill Subdivision. You know, it was kind of like the quantification of the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, all of a sudden swimming pools and Cadillacs and Here I was again around a whole new group of kids, you know, much smarter, much brighter. I wasn't doing very well in school. You know, my mom married a guy that, you know, very, very accomplished, very successful guy, but he was a full-blown alcoholic. I mean, a functional one, you know. Up in the morning early and jump in the wingtips and a pot of coffee and two Tylenol and hit the flask on the way out of Indian Hills in his Eldorado Cadillac. And, you know, hell, sometimes he wouldn't come home at night. And there was a lot of tumultuous evenings, you know, when, you know, he finally would come home. And although he never struck my mother, he never struck me, he never beat on me. You know, we were always provided for, you know. But I had a stepbrother, you know, about this time. And he was 16. And man, I had yearned for a sibling, you know, to have a sibling, you know, and especially an older brother, someone to look to, you know, and he was so cool, man. He was the coolest thing, I thought, man. He had the best beer can collection, had a big, he was an artist, too. He could draw. I mean, he was amazing, and he drew this, you know, Rolling Stones tongue on his wall and had this amazing background and listened to all the best music, and and he smoked weed, you know, and he drank, he smoked weed, and he grew it in the backyard in Indian Hills Subdivision, and, you know, I can remember, you know, early on like that, I was always looking up to people that were over me, and immediately, you know, I connected with this, you know, with him. And, you know, I was very young. I'll date myself here a little bit so people maybe get a chuckle out of it. I can remember the first concert I went to with my stepbrother and his girlfriend. And it was Peter Wolf with the harmonica, Freeze Frame, the Jay Giles band. And a little small no-name band opened up for him named U2. And anyway, obviously, Jay Giles' band's not around anymore, and U2 has done quite well. But, you know, I can remember we smoked weed, we had some beers, man, and I felt alive. I just felt, you know, released. It was like the fear and the anxiety had just kind of been pulled away, if only for a brief moment, you know. And it felt good, I mean, to get that, you know, release, you know, that came from a few drinks and you know, kind of hitting the weed. So, and I felt so cool because here I was with somebody that I just admired. And I honestly, even today, don't think that my stepbrother had a problem, you know, actually a mental obsession, a physical allergy. Because he, you know, he never got out of control like his father, but he could have crossed that line at some point. My mother, that was just, you know, one husband after my father, six marriages later, and she's still looking for lucky number seven, by the way. But we didn't live there but for, you know, a short period of time. And then it was back to, you know, apartment complexes again after a divorce. I think she married the guy twice. But anyway, I, from apartment complexes, I began to connect with people that were older than me, you know. And I was always drawn to people that were a little bit older than me. And I was in the East Cobb area at this time and going to East Cobb Middle School, which if anybody knows that area in the Wheeler District, East Cobb Middle School is right across the street from Wheeler High School, you know. And so, and I'm living in apartment complexes, you know, and, you know, drinking and going to keg parties, you know, on the weekends and sliding around. My mother's single and she's dating and she's not really aware of where I'm at. I'm just out, you know, playing with other kids in the neighborhood, right? So I began to run with kids that are a bit older than I am, you know, that they're 16, they have cars and they're going back and forth to school, and I'm sliding out the window at night, you know, and I'm talking about, you know, here I am at, you know, 12, 13 years old, you know, and I'm, you know, jumping the car, cruising around and drinking drinking more and enjoying it. And anyway, I began to have trouble in school, you know, the whole things with, you know, behavior and, you know, suspensions and, you know, still trouble with grades and likes and sort, and the school calling mom at work, he's not here, you know, and I've gotten in and went across the street to Wheeler and jumped in the car with somebody else, and, you know, we're out drinking, smoking weed in the middle of the day or whatever, you know. So anyway, my mom had just, you know, gotten really frustrated with it, and so my dad, who had constantly been trying to, you know, engage me in spiritual matters and get me involved in church, and, you know, and I was kind of getting the age where I just wasn't, you know, going with him on Sundays as much. But my mom finally called him and just said, "Hey, look, you know, I've dealt with it the first 13 years here, you know, and, you know, it's time for you to step up to the plate here, and, you know, I think he needs to come live with you." And so, anyway, dad was a firefighter, Cobb County firefighter, retired, would work 24 and all 48, you know, so it wasn't really feasible for me just to move into him, and I was still having trouble in school, so there was a little transition period there where they got me involved with somebody with my studies to help me, and she was a school teacher. Long story short, dad wound up dating her, she was my tutor, school teacher, and then about a year later she became my stepmother. And anyway, I moved in with both of them. You know, they tried to all of a sudden implement the parental guidance, right, that you know, that I'd never had, and I began to rebel, like all hell. I began to have, you know, what I didn't understand was maybe even some deep-seated resentment of not really ever having a mother or a parental figure or any of this stuff in my life. Plus, I felt like I was an adult, right? I needed to do what I wanted to do. I was smart enough to make the decisions I needed to make. And so, you know, I continued to, you know, still in the East Cobb district. We weren't far away over off Powers Ferry Road, and I'm still going out the windows at night, and, you know, smoking cigarettes at, you know, 14, 15 years old, and drinking and coming home extremely intoxicated. Sometimes people were calling Dad from the Galleria Mall. You know, it's back when the Galleria had a game room, and, you know, we'd get a fifth of liquor across Street Acres Mill, back when they had the Turtles record store there, and people would camp out for tickets and throw Frisbees all night till all hours of the morning, and, you know, we'd get high, and, you know, time of my life, you know, I thought, you know, but still had a, you know, just a lot of anger and stuff going on, and I remember my stepmother, you know, just told my dad, look, this behavior is unacceptable, and it's, you know, and it's concerning. It's very disconcerting. You know, this behavior's, you know, continuing like this. And, you know, I think we need to go see somebody and talk to somebody about this. And, you know, I really owe that to my stepmother, because I don't think that my parents would have either one have had the strength to see it or address it. long story short, they throwed me in a rehab and in the 80s over in Smyrna. And it was one of these long-term, you know, 11-month, you know, ordeals. Something that wouldn't even be legal these days, the way they locked people down, nailed windows shut, and carried people by the belt loop. I mean, it's about as close as you get to, like, juvenile detention is without being in juvenile detention. And it's a very structured program, and I learned a lot about it, about the steps, because they kind of had the 12 steps, but they condensed them down into 7. It was called Straight Incorporated. They had one that started in St. Petersburg, and then they started this one in Atlanta. And so the steps were there, and I got familiar with the steps a little bit. The only thing is, it was a little different, you know. So like a lot of these programs, not badgering programs or, you know, therapists or anything like that, but they try to take what we know works in the 12 steps in the book, you know, and then they try to give a different flavor on it, and take people through it, charge them some money, and then they send them to give them a $30,000 big book and tell them to go to a meeting, right? So anyway, I did learn a lot, you know, about the program, but there was some misconceptions there. They always talked about the disease of the feelings, and they always had to share us our feelings and how we felt, you know. And I don't know, maybe there was some help to that, but as I got into the program later, I found out it wasn't about how I felt. It was more about how I think, you know, and that I had a thinking problem, and my problem resided in my mind. I got out of rehab, 11 months, you know, and I was able to work my way up through those phases. You got the third or fourth phase. You could work and go to school and then come home, you know, to your house, you know, and you had host brothers and all this stuff. So I kind of collectively got around a group of people after 11 months that were going to meetings. And, you know, I kind of shifted away. We had moved up to the Sprayberry District. So I kind of got away from East Cobb, some people. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like, I mean, I'm in meetings. I'm going to young people's meetings. And, you know, I mean, in the 80s, I mean, it was just rocking. I mean, it was, you know, around here and especially over in Marietta, and we were going to a lot of different, you know, conferences. And but I have to say that I never really went through the big book. I'd never really gone through the first 164 pages. I'd never really had broken down and understood what the problem was after 11 months in a program, you know, and kind of hitting some other meetings. I'd never really, you know, listened. It was really more of a social thing and hanging out and meeting, you know, and people and running around, having fun. I mean, this was back when there were so many 16, 17-year-olds and stuff that had, you know, apartments up and down Roswell Road. And, you know, we were just having fun, but staying clean and sober. But I was kind of a dry drunk, you know, and even got back into school, got my high school diploma, even eventually got on into college. And but somewhere along that scale, I quit going to meetings. And, I mean, literally just backwards going through the 12 steps. Not that I ever really fully worked them the way they were intended to work, but, you know, I wasn't working with others. You know, I wasn't seeking through prayer and meditation and keeping a conscious contact with God. I wasn't praying and meditating. I wasn't, you know, admitting my shortcomings. And when I was wrong, I certainly wasn't taking any type of moral inventory or making amends. I certainly wasn't I'd pretty much taken my will back, because my lifestyle, even though I wasn't drinking or drugging, I got really selfish and self-centered in a lot of areas. You know, I had girlfriends that just terminated in a row. And then anyway, it was in my college year, my last year of college, that, you know, it was just like counting down, like a bomb going off, you know, through the steps, you know, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 1, you know. And, you know, it was as crazy as Jim putting, you know, milk in a shot of whiskey and milk. You know, I, you know, at 24 years old, picked up a drink again. It was either a coffee drink, a liqueur out of Chicago's restaurant off of Shalford Road, and was a group of other people I was working with at Sears at the time while I was finishing up my degree at Kennesaw. And they ordered one. I think it was even one they didn't want or something, and I took a sip, and what is that? Is it? Oh, it's actually a liqueur coffee drink. And I was like, well, that's pretty good. Certainly just a liqueur coffee drink wasn't going to hurt me, you know? I mean, but there was a whole mental state that proceeded to relapse. I've been drinking Coors Cutters and O'Doul's, you know, that kind of have that very, I mean, you could sit there and drink a case of them and never really feel a buzz. But the whole ambiance of drinking them and hanging out at the beach with my other college friends. And anyway, not long after that, I found myself at a party right here off Roswell Road with a six-pack of O'Doul's or Coors Cutters in the fridge. And I went in and picked up, you know, opened up the fridge, and my Coors Cutters I put in there were gone. I mean, I don't know who the hell would be drinking my non-alcoholic beer, you know. But everybody's like, hey, what's the problem? Chill out. It's no big deal. We got a keg on the patio out here, you know. So, boom. I mean, I can remember those first two big cups right out of the keg, and I hadn't had anything but that coffee drink, you know, a few weeks earlier. And man, all of a sudden that buzz. I mean, you go without a drink or a drug for, you know, that many years, then all of a sudden, I mean, it's unbelievable how the buzz hits in. And so anyway, long and short, I was off to the races. Started drinking, you know, beer regularly, and then started drinking alcohol, hard liquor, started doing shots, you know, within a year. I graduated, believe it or not, I was in the last semester. I mean, it was very cunning and baffling, just the way it slipped in. It was very cunning and baffling that first year and a half, 18 months of getting back into drinking. It was fun. Again, it was enjoyable. I was there again. I knew better. I knew better, but I had convinced myself that I was just a kid, you know. I was just a kid. I mean, they threw my ass in rehab and brainwashed me with all this, you know, bull BS. And, you know, so anyway, I can drink, you know, like other people. So within 18 months, you know, I was full blown. I was back drinking and partying. And for a while, it was a lot of fun. I was a sales rep, got a good job with an IT company here locally, and was making good money. And just like Bill and Bill's story, I mean, you know, fortune and applause was thrown my way for a while. I was making good money. I had a, you know, good way to talk to people and enjoy hanging out with people at happy hours. You know, the sales rep, you don't have to really make a sales call anyway till 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, you know. So I'd get up and, you know, pull off the flask a little bit, you know, just like one of the stepfathers I had, take a few Tylenol, drink some coffee, and, you know, show up and go meet people, you know, and keep you know, selling and enjoying what I was doing. And like I said, I was doing real well at it. I was making good money. God had really blessed me with that opportunity, but I was still living a lifestyle that was very selfish, very self-centered, very self-seeking, and very empty spiritually. I didn't, you know, well, about 18 months to 2 years into it, I started, you know, got my introduction for the first time to cocaine. And, man, I'd arrived. You know, this was even better. You know, I could shake the hangovers off and do a bump or two in the morning, and certainly could enjoy the drinking right on late into the night. And that took on for about another year or so, and that was great. And, you know, but I began to slip, you know, more and more. It, just like all the agnostic promises are in the big book, you know, just like we have the promise of the program, the agnostic promises just slowly begin to come right back in like a slow, subtle storm, you know. The fear, you know, the anxiety, you know, the depression, the, you know, not being able to sleep and getting paraminded, the whole double-mindedness of somebody who knows what they're doing is wrong, but yet trying to live a way that, you know, and keep fighting at it. So anyway, just like everybody, you know, pool halls, from Cowboys to Buckhead, I had a condo down here, I had a dealer down here, I was... started smoking it, you know, and that's, you know, I was an alcoholic through and through. I mean, I drank every day, and but functional, you know, but once I got down that path with that, it brought me to my knees, much like in Bill's story when he talked about drinking and a high-powered sedative, and the doctor came back and found him drinking, you know, high-powered sedative and alcohol. And so, you know, Bill was an anda, you know, an alcoholic and an addict. So anyway, I found myself, you know, just all of a sudden, you know, I mean, I was missing days of work, you know, I mean, I, you know, when I was just drinking, I could get in there, but I started missing days of work and disappearing for days, and people concerned, family, you know, friends, and the people I used to run the bars with, you know, the friends and girlfriends and fair-weather friends, they began to terminate in a row, you know, they just, they didn't hang around me because it was always a very volatile situation, you know, I mean, my drinking, you know, his proportions would get, you know, more, and I'd get high, and then I'd, you know, so anyway, I got where I was in a one-bedroom apartment in Kennesaw, my dad had a house down in Powers Ferry, and I expressed interest in kind of getting out of that area and getting back down, you know, in Powers Ferry Road over there and renting one of his houses. And I can remember I struggled for the first, you know, 90 days or so, and was, you know, living behind, you know, the blinds and doing all the stuff that comes with that lifestyle, and all of a sudden being, you know, alone, you know, and I really feared for my sanity, you know, going days like that, and you know, I would see things in the house, and, you know, I mean, the mind just, you know, I can remember showing up on the back row of church, you know, my dad's church and my stepmother's church, and, you know, praying for God to just help me, you know, and somehow I was still hanging on to my job. I'd been cornered a couple times, painted into a corner, but I never got honest with them about it, and was able to hang in there with that. But it was about that point in my life where I had been kind of painted into the darkest corner, you know, that I could be in, and had, you know, been involved in just all kind of filthy stuff and, you know, lifestyle that just comes with all that, the drinking and drugging and the shame and the remorse, and, you know, just as Bill said in his story, quicksand just sank all around me. And I can remember, you know, stumbling home from church with my dad and my stepmother at their house, and I told my dad, I said, I'm concerned for my sanity. I don't even think I can report into work tomorrow. And he said, well, why don't you just hang out here in the afternoon? Try to take a nap. I said, I can't sleep. You know, I haven't slept in a couple of days, and I can't sleep. He said, well, just hang out here. And I tried to eat some, you know, Sunday afternoon fried chicken and went into the bathroom and threw it up. And I can remember I tried to, you know, just get some rest there. And I can remember they prayed for me. And anyway, I went back home, and I suited up the next day. And my dad told me before I left, he said, look, you know, you don't have to go in and be honest about everything, but just go in and, you know, face the music the next morning. And it was the most amazing thing. I went in that morning, and there was a lot of stuff going on in work, and I'd been out in the field, and oddly enough, nobody confronted me this time about anything. It just kind of blew over, but I had such a yearning at this point in my life to change. And so I went over to the Friday night meeting in Sandy Springs, and I bumped into Dante and my friend Tonio and my buddy John, who John and I had been in straight. Back in, you know, we grew up together, and there were two or three other people in there that had been around before, and they kind of welcomed me with open arms, you know, and they said, hey, man, we're doing this deal right over here. You know, it's not the way maybe for some other meetings. I mean, we're going through this book, and we got a solution, and it's the solution, and, you know, that's great that you've been to church, and you've been prayed over, and, you know, your soul's fine, but your ass on this earth is in trouble if you don't take some action, because is a real alcoholic and drug addict, you know, you got to double down. You know, you can't just trust in the powers that be that's going to, you know, take it away. You got to put some action into it, and you got to get actively involved in recovery every day. I'll never forget my buddy Tony O, and he was in town this week, and we had dinner up off Metlock Road, and we were talking about that and how, you know, there were key things that stuck out about you have to get actively involved in recovery every day, and, you know, you don't have to believe everything I'm saying. You just have to, you know, have faith. You know, and I believed in God. I've been raised up. I believed in a lot of the tenets of it. I, you know, a lot of things I didn't agree with, but I believed in a God. I just didn't know of one that was really close and personal to me. And obviously hadn't been living a lifestyle to draw close unto one that was close and personal to me. But I made a start, you know. I mean, I got in the program, and I made a start, and I started coming to meetings. I started going to big book studies. There were small groups of us that were getting together and going through the book. I started going up to Dante's house. Went over to Tonio's house on Saturday mornings. Going through, you know, he would say, after the Friday night meeting, you call me on Saturday morning, and you come straight over to the house, and we'll go through the book. And so we'd do that. And then we'd go have some lunch. And then we'd go work out or something. And Sunday, I'd go to church, and I'd meet up with my parents. And then Monday, I'd have to go right back to work. Maybe Sunday night, I'd go back to church, or I'd find another meeting. And so I made sure I stayed actively involved in recovery and spiritual matters, and stayed focused on, you know, doing what I needed to do. And the obsession kind of slowly, you know, I can't really say where the obsession was removed. I just, I kept showing up. I was kind of fingernail biting it. You know, I didn't have some spiritual experience. Although I will say this, I did have a moment when I was, I can remember I was driving down to my grandmother's. I had about 90 days clean and sober. I was up, you know, crack of dawn, and the sun was just coming up, and you could kind of see the mist kind of rising, you know, through the farm country going down through South Georgia. And I had some, you know, praise, inspirational music going, and I was just praying and meditating. And all of a sudden, I just had this, I mean, I can't even explain it. I began to just welt up and cry. You know, it was like, all of a sudden, I just felt like I knew that it was going to work this time. You know, I'd made so many attempts. I picked up so many of these white chips, you know, for about a year coming in and out of the program that I just, but all of a sudden, I knew that I was with the right people, they had the right solution. And, you know, and it was just a warmness that covered me that I knew that this time this ship was going to work. You know, it was going to work. I was with the right group of guys. We were going through the book, you know, and I had a peace, you know. And, you know, I came back and I kept, you know, doubling down, getting in the book. My sponsor told me, he said, you got to start getting other people in the book. I said, well, we haven't even got to the fourth step. He goes, I don't care. We're in these book studies. We've gone through the Fords. We've gone through the doctor's opinion. You've been fully well informed of what the problem is, you know, that you've got a mental obsession. It's been removed, you know, and obsession is defined as an idea that overrides all other ideas. It's the only explanation that someone with such smarts and ingenuity and drive and you know, success could, you know, cast all that aside and fall into that pit to drink and drug again, is that you had this mental obsession, you know, this idea that overrides all other ideas. And once you fall into that, not only did that problem center in your mind, but you were physically, it was a body and mind, and the body had the physical allergy, you know, and you had the physical allergy, and the physical allergy was the phenomenon of craving, and once you put dope or drink in, that, you know, that craving expressed itself as wanting more, craving more. And so, you know, Tony took me through that, and he said, you can start taking other people through the book immediately, and you can start sharing, you know, clearly what the people's problem is so that they know, and then, you know, you take them into the solution. And then, you know, just keep taking people through. Some people will drop off, some will come along, some will show up for our book study, but you start your own book study, you bring them over to my book study, and we keep taking people through the book. So that's what I did. You know, I wasn't fully confident that it was still going to work, but I just knew I was feeling better, and I had some confidence, and I had some peace. And so that's what I kept doing. And I kept stepping out on a little bit of faith, and, you know, God would, you know, reveal himself more deeper, you know, to me by taking a little bit of action. I'd get some results. I'd have some little more trust in the process. And it took me a while to do my fourth and fifth step. I mean, I had a lot of things I had to put down on there, and you know, I had to learn that, you know, I was very, although I had, you know, was very sick, you know, in mind and body, that I also was very selfish and self-seeking and self-centered, and that all my selfishness then manifested itself in my fears and my harms and my resentments toward other people. And I had to get down to the root causes of those, and I had to get it down on paper. But the book broke it down, and my sponsor broke it down so with such clarity and such, you know, precision, and didn't even throw it all at me. I did it in pieces, you know. And I went through the fourth step, and I did a fifth step, and I started doing my amends. And at the same time, I'm still taking people through the book. And you know, got deeper, you know, in involved in the program, I began to find that I really had a passion. I mean, that became the juice, you know, was helping other people get clean and sober. You know, I would see people come in that were going through the same thing that I had been through. And, I can't say that I was just relieved from everything. I mean, I stand here today and I still have, you know, times where fear can creep into my life, you know, but I notice it much more quickly nowadays. You know, I mean, if I start to get irritable and restless and discontent, I see it, you know, coming, you know, and I know where the lights are to get right back on the path, because I know that sitting in an area or stewing in the old way of thinking of getting irritable and restless and discontent is really an area of selfishness and self-centeredness, you know, that God's given me the willingness and to make decisions that I need to make, and you know, as long as my utter reliance and dependency is upon Him, and my motives are right, and I seek discernment, you know, through Him and through my fellows and friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that are close to me, my family, and get counsel, and I'm open and receptive to it, and you know, I step out on faith. And sometimes I fail at things. I don't fail at drinking and drugging. That's been removed, and you know, thankful to Alcoholics Anonymous and God, you know, who lives in me and through me in a much more powerful way than I could ever imagine, you know, and never dreamed that I could have a close personal relationship. You know, I'd always believed that, you know, there was a God, that there was, you know, I mean, look out at the leaves and the trees and the air that we breathe and the beautiful evening and things. I always believed there was a creator of, you know, it was much more than just, you know, there had to be divine intelligence, but being able to, you know, like it says on page 86, and get down and really just take that mental reprieve daily and seek God. And, you know, when I look back over it, you know, I mean, there had to be one. I mean, like I said, when I look back at the lifestyle I lived and so many, probably like all of us, just situations that I shouldn't have walked out of. I mean, you know, I can't even count, you know, the situations that just narrowly escaped death's flames of being shot or killed or beat half to death and waking up in, you know, emergency rooms. And, you know, it's just, there was a God that carried me right through that, you know. And, you know, if my parents were here, my dad, he would say that, you know, my stepmother used to wake him in the middle of the night and say, we need to pray. You know, there's something going on. I mean, she had that much, you know, spiritual insight and would be awoken in the middle of the night. And it was probably some of those nights, you know, that things were going like that. So, you know, I know there's a God, you know, and I know He's a loving God. I know He's a forgiving God. I know that there's no terrible thing, you know, no sin too great, no, injustice too wrong, you know. And, you know, I mean, I've broken just about all the Ten Commandments at one time or another. And, you know, it's, I've never killed anybody, I don't think, but I always told people, you know, I said, hey, look, you know, suicide's not really, although I went through some rare, you know, deep depression and drinking days, but I always said, you know, if somebody shows up somewhere and said, you know, and I'm dead, and they said that, you know, it looks like he committed suicide, I said, you need to investigate that, because that's not the case. You know, I never could cross that line. Homicide, maybe, you know, I could kill somebody, maybe, but I didn't really. I was worked through all the anger and the resentment and the bitterness, and God was able to give me a new way to think, really. I mean, that's what the big book does. That's what the 12-step does, by God, in God, through God, doing my part. It really changed the way I think, you know, because the problem centered in my mind. So my whole attitude and outlook upon life, changed as a result of the program. It changed the way that I looked at things, you know. I mean, it wasn't about me, you know. When I first came into the program, you know, that, you know, the newcomer is the most important person in the meeting, you know. And I thought, well, hell, I know that, you know. I mean, that's when my first day, I was like, well, yeah, I knew that. Tell me something I don't know, you know. So, there again, that terminal uniqueness, right? So, I learned that it wasn't about me. It wasn't, you know, it was about, you know, my best thinking and all my efforts drained me to the point where my best thinking got me on the front row of a cocaine or AA, Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Broken, you know, destitute. I mean, and I'd blown through so much money. I had so many credit cards at such levels, you know, and, you know, nothing to show for it. You know, I mean, driving around in an old car, and, you know, people were like, man, what are you doing that? You know, some of my colleagues were like, what, you know. I finally got a car allowance at one point, but it was, you know, it was just, I was just, you know, I'd blown a lot of money. So all of a sudden, you know, I got a couple roommates that were in the program. I was living over off Powers Ferry Road. And begin to pay off my bills. Basically moved two roommates in this three-bedroom house, and they were paying the bills pretty much for me, and I was just paying my debts off. And slowly but surely, you know, I tried to get right back and make all wrongs right, and, you know, I had to call these creditors, I had to call these people and communicate that, you know, this is what has been going on in my life. And some of them even cut deals with me. It was like, you know, kind of get excited. It was like the old dope living. Well, I can cut a deal, you know, there's no problem with that. We can cut a deal. So, but it was really, you know, God working, you know, in the middle of the situation, and me just surrendering that whatever was going to happen was going to happen. Unbelievably, I kept my job. You know, But most importantly, you know, it's funny how I say that, because that was my biggest fear. I was losing my job. Everything was going to come down. The world was going to come crashing down. You know, but, you know, the biggest thing was that I had fully gotten on a level plane of discerning who I was. You know, all my life I didn't know, you know, I was trying to be something to everybody else, and all I had to do was trust God and be me, you know. And you know, I think about some of the guys in the program, and Jerry, and so many people, you know, that I've gotten clean and sober with, and that I've seen, you know, grow in this fellowship, and how dedicated they were to their drinking and their dope use, and you know, and me too, and then how dedicated they get to this program, you know, if they just turn and they channel that energy, you know, once being armed with the facts and having a defense against the first drink, which is having a spiritual growth and having God work in us and through us 24/7. I mean, it's just that way, the book says, or we die, you know. And there's another thing Tony O told me, you know, as we were going through the book, you know, that God was everything or he was nothing, and that, you know, I smashed that idea. I mean, I knew that to drink was to die, and that the obsession had been removed. And all I had to do was live life on life's terms, you know, and things were challenging. There were hurdles. They were up and down. I left one job, had to go to another job. I lost my stepmother, the one who had been, you know, instrumental in my recovery, that had, you know, thrown me in that rehab in, you know, my teenage years, and had prayed for me for years, and it was very sudden in her 60s, and, you know, routine procedure that went awry, and 45 days in ICU, and I was up there every day, you know, and we were right there with her, and but I never once thought about picking up a drink or getting high. You know, I knew that God loved her, and that God loved me, and that God loved my dad, and that, you know, that we would see her again, and that she was going to be okay, and we were going to be okay. So I've gone through that. I've gone through the loss of a friend a few weeks ago. I had a very close friend in the program. Did stay clean and sober for the longest time. You may have seen it on the news up in Alpharetta. He was hit on a bicycle, and wasn't his fault. Somebody crossed the line and hit him head on, and he was in the hospital up at North Fulton here for a few days and a couple days, and died. And, you know, and his wife and his kids and are, you know, adjusting. My wife is highly involved in their lives right now, and I am too. And we, you know, things happen. We don't understand them. You know, sometimes, you know, I mean, God, you know, well, I can't, you know, just reach out of the sky sometime, but he gives us free will, you know, gives us free will to make decisions and take actions, and unfortunately gives other people free will too. So, you know, I've got peace today with God. You know, I got peace that, you know, surpass all understanding. I know that I don't have to understand everything. I'm not God. I don't have to control everything. I don't have to be the actor and the director, and, you know, and I'm in sales, you know. I mean, I work with people, and sometimes I catch myself, you know, and it's like I back up and I have to keep focus on their needs, you know. And they may not need my solution, you know. Their infrastructure, their environment, their goals and their aspirations may not need my solution. But if I can ask enough questions and fully understand what their problem is, if I've got a solution, can align it to it, and it's looking out for their best needs, it's a done deal. And God's done it over and over again, you know. And he just, sometimes I quickly realize that's not the one. I don't need to invest time. I got to move on to the next one. And it seems like that things have just worked out. So about 2 years clean and sober, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that I met a beautiful, lovely lady that I've been married to now for 9 years. She drinks a little bit of wine once in a while, but she's never been a big drinker, never touched any drugs. She jokes around about how, you know, she kissed the frog that became the prince. You know, she likes to joke around about the toad, you know, and because we are two totally different, you know, ends of the spectrum. I mean, she was raised with, you know, parents and a little home and father that worked, and everything kind of just blossomed up, and she just can't even fathom sometimes when I share with her. You know, she's like, that's crazy. How do you think that way? You know, I'm always, you know, kind of skeptical about things at times and look over my shoulder, and you know, I mean, for example, we were up at the lake. I mean, God's blessed us. We've got a home up in Alpharetta. It's not about the things. It's really more about, you know, what they represent, not necessarily what they are, but what they represent of God's, you know, blessing us. And we got a little place up on Lanier, and we go up there on the weekends and unplug, and it was kind of funny because there were some people that were not supposed to be there that were knocking around on somebody else's dock, and we knew they weren't supposed to be there, but you know, as long as they were being calm, it wasn't a big deal. But then it turned into the next weekend, it was like about 12 or 13 or 14 people that were there. And they were climbing around on my neighbor's dock, and I'm thinking, you know, climbing off his dock. So we had to say something to him, you know. I was like, hey, you got permission to be on, you know, Mr. and Ms. So-and-so's dock there? No? Okay, well, that's private property. And anyway, they about half of them or two-thirds of them scattered. They took off. And a few of them came back, and I told my wife, I said, well, those ones that took off, those were the ones that had, you know, some minors, priors, you know, a couple of misdemeanors and stuff like that. And she's like, how do you think this stuff? You know, I mean, how do you think that way? I was like, well, you know, it's just... You know, that would be me back then, right? I knew that. I mean, I just, you know, I mean, the ones that stuck around, you know, I mean, the other ones are like, they heard private property, sheriff, you know. But it's things like that all the time. I'll say something, and she's just like, she doesn't get it. You know, she gets it, but she's like, I just don't know how you think that way. But she is a blessing. She has really been responsible over the last 6 or 7 years of, you know, her spiritual growth. And I'm always open in the 11th step, 10th and 11th step, to hear other people's insight of continuing to pray and seek and learn and discern deeper about spiritual matters, and she's been a rock for me, and has encouraged me, and I can't say enough about that. She also is out actively involved in other people's life. I see it through her example, sowing into other people and working, encouraging them, and she keeps me. She's the real driver. She likes to drive. I'm ambitious and stuff, but let me say it like this. I like to work hard, but I just don't like to be pushed. We had to kind of get that clear right out of the gate. You know, I was like, hey, I don't mind working hard, but I just don't like to be pushed. But really, when you think about it, though, I mean, we as alcoholics, recovered drug addicts, I mean, we're some of the hardest, you know, most determined people, you know, in life. I mean, it's some people look at it as a weakness, but you know, and we are bodily and mentally different than our fellow. Speaking for myself, I am. I had the mental obsession; it was removed. Still have the physical allergy as long as I don't put anything, I don't drink. But I never quit anything in my life. You know, I mean, I had difficulty quitting the things I needed to quit. You know, I failed to mention that somewhere in there, I between trying to get clean and sober the second time, I got back into a grad school program out at Kennesaw State and almost flunked out of it my first semester, and I was in there like an animal house under double secret probation. You know, I mean, my CSAT scores or whatever the scores you had to take to get CSAT to get into the MBA program, but they were so bad that you know, I had to, you know, they put me under this probationary period where, hey, you got to get a 3.2, which basically meant I had to have an A and two B's. I mean, three B's weren't going to cut it. An A and a B and a C weren't going to cut it. I had to have an A and two B's. My first 15-hour credit hours, or I just, Kennesaw, you know, wasn't going to let me in. But I'd been in their undergrad program, so I was a paying customer. You know, I had that figured out. You know, I was like, hey, I'm a paying customer. I mean, I'm working over here, you know, with an IT company locally. So anyway, long story short, I got the A the first go around. It wasn't easy because it's hard to get an A when you're drinking and drugging and, you know, but there again, back to how driven, you know, we are. Fortunately, it was a very, you know, kind of walk-through class, and I had some help. But I had to drop out when I signed up for Tuesday Next because my, you know, drinking got so heavily. And then I got clean and sober, and after 90 days or so, and working in the book with Tony O, and I jumped back into the program, I mean, into school, and was able to double down, and eventually, 3 years later, and I got to credit this to my wife because I got to the last two classes, and just like a lot of things in my life, and to be quite honest with you, even today, even this year, you know, things I could work and build up in my head when the pressure gets so great at work, just like it did with school in those last two classes of my MBA, you know, I wanted to drop them. I just like, look, I'm working too hard, I'm traveling too much, and I'm going to have to drop them. My wife was like, I think she had it in her mind that, look, if this guy's ever going to ask me to marry him, I got to get him through this MBA program and get him, you know, get him away from school, because we were literally just kind of catching up on the weekends. But she started helping me in my studies in the last two classes, and I got a credit to her. She got me through those last two classes, and she'd like to say that I proposed immediately. It took me another 2 years dancing on my feet a little bit to settle down, but there again, some of the same, you know, all my thinking and not, you know, just completely letting go and letting God and stepping forth in faith. But I did eventually, and it's just been a tremendous blessing. But I say that with the passion back on how driven we are, and if we can just let go and trust God and you know, step forth into a new way of living, designed for living, and the spiritual tool has been laid at our feet, and not give up on that, you know, and not quit. I mean, Tony O taught me very early on was to, you know, to drink was to die, and to give up, you know, and drink and to quit, you know, on this program was to die. And like I said, I'd never quit anything in my life, and even those things I needed to quit, I had a hard time quitting. So once I got, you know, in it for the second go around this time, I had a full knowledge of my condition. I'd been armed with the facts. I knew what the problem was. I knew that I had to stay on top of selfishness and self-centered every day, but I also knew that I couldn't quit. I couldn't give up. You know, couldn't quit on it. So, and with that, I'll close with a poem my dad taught me. You know, my dad's he's a poet. Didn't know it. He's really good with. I mean, this guy, he's got a memory. It's unbelievable. He can quote and recite, you know, the entire Christmas story out of Luke. But he knows a lot of great poems. Anyway, he taught me one though early on through this season of my life, and one that still, you know, sticks and resides with me today. You know, at times when I go through these real challenging times at work and want to just say F them and throw in a towel, you know, and I don't look at it as quitting. I look at it as exiting from an undesirable place. But I know I can't do that, you know, without another option that God opens up. It's in God's time, not mine. So anyway, he's taught me not to quit. And the poem is Don't Quit. When things go wrong, as they sometimes will, when the path you're trudging seems all uphill, when the funds are low and the debts are high, when you try to smile but you have to sigh, if care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but don't you quit. Life is filled with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns. Now many a fella is turned about when he might have won had he stuck it out, but learned too late when the night came down how close he was to the victor's crown. Success is failure turned inside out, and the silver lining is the clouds of doubt. We never know how close we are. It may be near when it seems so far. So don't give up, though hardest hit. It's when things seem worse, we must not quit. Thank you for having me tonight.